tries to formulate a political philosophy based on the ethics of what is good for one man, or what is just for one man, what is legal for one man to do. You cannot make it unjust or illegal for another man to do. You find it kind of hard and inconsistent to let go of certain statist properties of your ideology that you had previously emerged from. Being that you came from the left or the right, it can be very, very hard to reconcile or to come to grips with the former statist that you were. But I don't know. This is just me vamping, aka Nick Way. I'm back with another Proto Podcast, just trying to pump these things out to get my thoughts on wax, so to speak. And I don't particularly have much of a theme. Maybe that'll emerge as I kind of vamp for the next, we'll try to keep these to like a half hour, about my political philosophy. So maybe I should give my story, take some of my grassroots leadership training and build my narrative, my story about how I came to libertarianism. And do I even call myself still a libertarian? Yes, I think I can fully embrace that title. Whether some people accept me as a purebred libertarian, I learned as I've gotten kind of older and, you know, got out of the game of wanting to join the right gang, I think I can just say for myself that I am a conservative first, libertarian second. I'm God-fearing, though I am not a normal church-going guy. I am a good old-fashioned nationalist. I have served in her armed forces. I have helped protect and spread the tyranny of the empire. And while I can admit that maybe some of the missions that the United States military has conducted over the last 30 years, some have been unjust, I do not turn my back on the brethren, because we suffer. And I had an experience this weekend that keeps that in perspective constantly. But I am a patriot, first and foremost. I believe we live in the greatest country that man has ever conceived, despite its faults. I do not accept what the social justice left says is the constant and almost universal but perpetual oppression of the minorities that have come to this country, that live in this country, that have built this country. It has its faults, but at the end of the day, I think we're, for the most part, as a country, we're kind of the shit. That said, I mean, you know, let's not totally be sycophantic and, you know, worship my Lord and Savior government. Let's understand that there are limits, and those limits are around property rights, non-aggression, and generally a cosmic justice that points always, always toward human freedom. But I said first and foremost that I was a conservative. And what does that mean to me? Well, it isn't what is conservatism considered today, and not to date this, because I want to make this episode pretty evergreen, but it isn't Trumpian conservatism, which is kind of what I found to be that sycophantic conservatism, that anything that the Trump administration does and says is good. As I make this recording, there have been many, many things the Trump administration has done has been very, very good. On the net, I think it's been a 50-50 presidency. You know, if you can separate the rhetoric from the administration. But that is not the type of conservative I am. That is not the type of conservative that I was brought up to become. My conservatism comes from really many roots. First and foremost, I was born and raised in Charleston, South Carolina. Attended church through, you know, means of bribery with my grandmama. And grew up in a single parent home. I know the value of work. I saw my mom work hard because she had two babies' daddies. One abandoned her and went back to his home country of Nigeria. That would be my father. The other didn't stick around much. And though his family was involved with my sister and I, never quite accepted my mother. See, she was a single mother. And that ugly side of conservatism is where I come from. You have a healthy mistrust of the state, in the form of the popo or the police, and you always understood that you may not, while you are openly not treated like a second class citizen, you're always kind of raised to think that you are. I think that's the detriment of the African American community, is this self-imposed belief that everyone's out to get you. Some of us, it turns us into victims. Others of us, it turns into, you know, hustlers. But growing up in that environment, I learned to still love my country, understand that slavery was a thing, plantations are museum pieces where I come from, and you learn the, you know, silly vernacular of the War of Northern Aggression. But that is where I came from. So growing up there around a military environment, in a military environment, because in the days I grew up in Charleston, two branches of the armed forces dominated. One was the United States Navy. At the time, Charleston Naval Base was one of the largest naval bases on the East Coast, behind Norfolk, Virginia. And then Charleston Air Force Base, a major logistical hub, moving planes, material, and personnel between here, Delaware, and Europe. My aunt joined the United States Air Force, and that gave me exposure to other lands within the continental U.S., because I would stay with her in the summers when she lived in Florida. So I'm very much a Southerner at heart. My mom married a Navy man, and I lived around in a military community. And that's where my love of other peoples who didn't look quite like me developed. I had white girlfriends, I had black girlfriends, I had Puerto Rican girlfriends. It was international. We all wanted to go places that our daddies were going. And make no mistake, most of us daddies were in the Air Force or the Navy or Marine Corps. So that's kind of my upbringing. We eventually moved to Norfolk, Virginia. And, you know, the rest is history from that standpoint of my life. But this is more of not a autobiographical, like, look at my life, but really my philosophical and ideological evolution. And the more I kind of look back at it as an old man, the more I look at it and like, yeah, it started in Charleston. It started in the South, the former stronghold of the Confederacy. It started in the church, even though I had to be bribed to go to church, because I would get all-you-could-eat Ryan's buffet and a Toys R Us visit. I would also listen to a lot of political speech. So there was this cable access show that would come on, and this old white man with glasses would talk about the politics of Charleston. It intrigued me, right? Because they're bitching about things like the annexation of Daniels Island, which was an island north of downtown Charleston that wasn't actually part of Charleston, but that was the big thing. And other issues of the day. Mayor Joe Riley was the mayor of Charleston, South Carolina for almost my entire adult life until just, 4 years ago. This was the time. Democrats were conservatives. Democrats believed in the church. Democrats believed in country, the military. They were pro-life. People who got pregnant simply didn't get abortions. It just didn't happen. And it wasn't because there wasn't access. See, Roe v. Wade aside, most people don't co-sign that lifestyle. So that's my evolution, right? Because I think one can read books and listen to podcasts, or at that time, talk radio as it was emerging. And, you know, that is your ideology, but you don't understand the etymology of your ideology starts from how you were born, your history, your story. Because most people's historical perspective starts the day they were born. That said, getting kind of interested in the political realm, I tend to remember getting up early in the morning to get ready for school when I was going to Goose Creek High School, seeing this white man on the TV, because I could only get like 7 channels. For those of you who don't tend to believe that I am from the past and we live in the future, I only had 7 channels to watch. One of these channels, the show came on early in the morning, the Rush Limbaugh Show. And this man was clowning on the president. And it intrigued me. So I would listen to Rush in the morning to get me ready for work. I mean, not work, but school or prison, depending on how you look at it. Government schools, you know how that is. And so I went. And I would just see the world differently because this white man on TV was just kind of like spitting hot garbage about Hillary Care at the time and doing these skits about back alley prescriptions and, you know, catchy little jingles about this, you know, about the welfare state and all this other stuff. And I just found that stuff pretty intriguing. Very intriguing, actually. But I didn't think much of it. Because you got to think, man, I came up in a time, early gangster rap, the LA riots, all this stuff. This is my history. This is what I came up as. But I didn't have that political evolution. I just thought this guy was kind of entertaining. Fast forward to our time when I moved to Virginia. And I'm stuck in Chesapeake Bay, not the Chesapeake Bay Tunnel. I forgot which tunnel it's called. This is in Norfolk, in the Hampton Roads area. And me and my homeboy are coming back from Virginia Beach, which, you know, having, you know, Virginia Beach, because we go to the mall out there. They had a really dope mall out there, Lynn Haven Mall. And so we were just kind of sitting in traffic, because you typically sit in traffic when there's a wreck in the tunnel. And I'm just kind of panning around in the AM dial. I don't know why. I think maybe the Fuji CD had got to the end and we were just tired listening to that Fuji CD. And we're just like, all right, what else is on? And I think I wanted to know, like, oh, I wanted to know why we were in this traffic jam. And as we snaked through this traffic jam, I tend to notice that, like, on one of the signs said, tune in to AM, blah, blah, blah. To whatever. I tuned in. There was no information on there. However, Rush Limbaugh was on there. The guy who I grew up listening to early in the morning as I got ready for school was on the radio. And I kept listening. So this began my political evolution. And then, of course, I'm living in this time, Red State, Virginia. We used to call it Commonwealth State because it was just so repressive. And its rules, blue laws, regulations, it was just so fucking conservative. The joke there in Virginia at that time was, how many conservatives do you need to change a light bulb? The answer is none. No one's going to change anything. It's Virginia at the time. So, that said, I'm already in the military community. I'm in a red state. I then start listening to a lot of talk radio. And then that's when I discovered Howard Stern, which I loved early Howard Stern in that point in the 90s, man. It was just so awesome. Because one, he was cussing on the radio. And two, he would just go in on people. I remember one day he was going in on, like, Mancow. I mean, just going in on this dude. And cussing up a storm. I'm just like, who is this dude? And this, you know. That is the beginning of that dichotomy. The staunchly living in staunchly red state, conservative Virginia, listening to Rush Limbaugh. And then at the same time, listening to Howard Stern. And, you know, you don't really think about those things, those inputs, those influences. And really just kind of joining the military, trying to keep my nose clean, you know. And I joined the United States Air Force in September of 1997. When you join the military, you're joining the fraternity of people who are staunchly a lot more conservative than the cats you grew up with. And my love of Limbaugh continued. I would listen to him as often as I could. But after about basic training, I just couldn't listen to him at all. And then, of course, I went to school in the South when it comes to technical training post basic training. And I didn't rediscover, like, my political ideology or philosophy or even my boy Rush until I moved out here to New Mexico. So I arrived here in July of 1998. And, you know, the rest was history. You know, I remember the Monica Lewinsky saga. I remember being influenced by my NCOIC and all these other people who were just conservative. They just saw the world differently. We also didn't like the fact that we were being Meals on Wheels, and no one liked the fact that we were going to Bosnia and Black Hawk Down had happened a couple of years prior. And the military was really not thought of in as high regard as it is sort of worshipped today for the most part. But I just remember, man, listening to the Ken Starr report and the salacious details and seeing, and this is the first time I kind of learned about hypocrisy. When I realized, like, any officer in my unit or enlisted in my unit, or at the very least, anyone in my unit who would sexually take advantage of a subordinate, even if it was consensual, was wrong. And any one of us in that work center, any one of us in that communications detachment would have been summarily drummed out of the Air Force. And, this is when I started to believe, like, wow, certain people who hold certain ideological values can get away with murder. And the fact that I'm a guy who likes big girls anyway, and I thought Monica Lewinsky, you know, was kind of cute, and I could kind of understand why Billy Clinton went after her. I mean, he's a Southerner like myself. We like healthy women. What can I say? You know, I was a fan. And also, you know, the dirty little secret among most people who thought of Bill Clinton as the first black president was, yeah, man, they're just going after him because he's getting a blowjob in the White House. And while I was very, very sympathetic to that view, at the same time, as a man in the military, I was just like, any one of us would have been drummed out of the service. Fast forward to 2000. I got orders to Germany, and I subsequently came to Germany in June of 2000. At this point, I'd been in the service a while, and I was politically all red. Back before that was a thing. You know, I look back at those times. USS Cole had happened right when I got there, and then the elections of 2000, and the subsequent aftermath of that. And that's when it began to really dawn on me that politics were gross in a game, and we looked very bad to the Europeans over there. And a lot of the reason why we looked bad to Europeans is because we had kind of projected, or at the very least kind of gave off this appearance that we were better than them. But our democratic institutions and our democratic systems were failing us. And I couldn't argue these, you know, in these German bars, I couldn't argue it. I understood. Yeah, at the time, I was on team GOP. I was less conservative, but just more team GOP. That's thanks to Limbaugh. That's thanks to a litany of things. And I was just like, these goddamn Democrats are trying to take the goddamn election. And in hindsight, let's be real, they were. But they did lose the election by 538. And the Electoral College went to George W. Bush. George W. Bush seemed like an affable guy. Didn't seem like a great guy, but he was definitely going to be better than Bill Clinton, because Bill Clinton was the worst. I would, as I got older, much more mature politically and much more historically, I would learn that Bill Clinton really wasn't that bad. He may have had moral failings, but he wasn't a terrible president. And particularly because we had split government that actually kind of worked with the Republican Congress and his astute political acumen. From 95 on, man, we did pretty damn well. But as is always happens, we get these typical cyclical recessions. And so Bush came in at a recession and everybody blamed Bush, and it wasn't Bush's fault, and I was on Team Bush. Then I got told, I had a great time my first year in Europe before I got married. And I remember going to just being there, and I think there was legalized prostitution. B40, Federal Bundesroad 40. That was just, it was crazy. I don't think marijuana or cannabis use had been quite decriminalized yet, but I think that would follow. And I took a visit to Amsterdam during, I think it was a European Championship. And there's just people from all over the world, all over Europe, and bitches, and you know, booze, and gambling, and prostitution, and dudes smoking weed, cigarettes, and ecstasy-laced stuff, and it was crazy. And I'm just like, wow, this is how you should live. And I began to really, really hate the puritanical nature that was the United States. But then, you know, as that year went on and summertime went down and turned all into, got into fall, so to speak, my wife told me, oh, by the way, I'm pregnant and, you know, you're about to have a daughter. And then I start, well, time to stop partying and bullshitting and slutting around and put a ring on the finger and make this a family. Because at the end of the day, man, I was raised pretty traditional. So that's what I did. September 11th, 2001. I'm at work. We're getting into the latter part of the day. And suddenly, the internet slowed down. I didn't know why. Did some refreshing on Yahoo. A plane had hit one of the World Trade Center towers. That was strange. I wonder if that's why. I mean, there's a lot of news flying around. Maybe that's why. I decided, well, I'm going to go downstairs and use the bathroom. And then we had a lot of TVs in the break rooms and some of the other areas, and that's when you saw one of the towers on fire. What the hell was going on there? It's just like, I didn't really think about it. Went to go use the bathroom. And I was thinking about cutting out early because, ironically enough, I was going to go pick up my wife and newborn daughter from the airport that day. Well, as it so happened, they would not fly in for 2 weeks. A second plane would hit the second tower. Within 2 to 3 hours, both of the towers were gone. And we were at war. The horrible, dreaded war on terrorism had begun. And this is when your lovely host was neoconned up. And was ready to go and wanted every Arab capital to burn. But what had happened, honestly, truly, was something, as the years would go on, was a consequence of the fact that we were this kind of global empire. But I can get back to that later. The intelligence community, because at the time I was now working in military intelligence, had known very quickly that a lot of the hijackers came from. A lot of them had spent time in Germany, ironically enough, where I was. Not to mention the fact that this was something that was thought about, but and was even somewhat predicted, but no one really knew. So no one knew ahead of time. I'm not proclaiming that. That's dumb. But it definitely, all the pieces eventually did come together days after the fact, as the kind of ruins and the smoldering ruins of like Ground Zero were there. So, like I brought a kid into this world. It's time to go to war. And full neocon going forward for the coming 2 to 3 years. But one thing did strike out at me at the time. Two things struck out at me at the time. The night I got home, because I was living off base, and when I got home late that night, how quiet my street was. And this is Europe in kind of late summer going into fall and stuff like that. So the sun wasn't quite, the sun was down, but I tend to remember that it was a warm night. And so typically there's no, back then there was not a lot of places had central air, particularly in my town in Germany of Wendweiler. and all the windows were up. And all I could hear was like the low frequency hum of the TVs. And every one of them was on the news, talking in German, giving minute by minute updates. And it was just quiet, and that's all you heard, all up and down the street. So I got into the house, sat down. It took 2 to 3 hours to get through because the main switching lines were completely flooded, so it was hard to get phone calls in and out of the continental U.S. And I just remember, like, this was a surreal day. The other thing I tend to remember is, as we were gearing up for war, the inevitable invasion of we don't know who, we got a briefing from a chaplain. And this briefing was a chaplain. The briefing from this chaplain was discussing Islam. And he broke down the religion and, you know, all this other stuff. But something really occurred to me during that whole talk. Something he brought up in his talk. The Islamic peoples, I guess, that those who were believers in Islam and stuff, were a great and mighty empire that believed in, like, science and reason and God. Somehow, that progressive way of looking at the world, from Arabic to all kinds of stuff, somehow that stopped and ceased, and then they turned in on themselves and became a very barbaric Abrahamic religion. And that kind of shocked me in a little way. It's just like, well, what happened to this great religion in the empire for which it was established around it, that it just turned inward on itself? And it always just kind of intrigued me, but those are just two different things. So, a warrior in the war on terrorism, I was. You know, did a couple assignments in Germany. The first assignment that put doubt in my mind about what we were doing was honestly, truly, my first deployment to Iraq under the auspices of the intelligence community. I tend to remember it too, as this very progressive master sergeant to Air Force, not Air Force, but he was an Army master sergeant from Fort Meade, who was hated Bush, was a big believer in the ACLU, and really got me starting to question why we were there. And then when you look at the dysfunction of the intelligence organizations, you start to realize that, Jesus Christ, we don't know what we're doing here, do we? We stirred up the sectarian war. We turned over control of the country so quickly. And the sectarian war broke out, for which we were not helping matters. And it began to become very, very apparent to me that maybe, I think maybe we're part of the problem. Now, I can't give total credit to my experience in Iraq that first time. I had been reading, you know, other literature. You know, I was reading Reason magazine, and because what drew me in the Reason was Drew Carey, because I was a Drew Carey fan. And I was also a avid listener still to Rush Limbaugh. But I tend to remember, I don't know what day it was or what time it was before my first Iraq experience, where he had a guest host on by the name of Walter E. Williams, pushing back the frontiers of ignorance and calling taxation legalized extortion, and using the example of, you can't go up the street, rob some dude, and then go down the street and give it to someone else and call it charity. I've never heard it put that way. You know, taxation is theft. He would also have on Thomas Sowell, who I read his first book, Basic Economics. And of course, because I'm a black man, and I wanted to seek out other identities like myself. So that drew me to Larry Elder. And I mean, I was listening to alternative voices. I did not understand that these alternative voices were more classically liberal, libertarian voices. And if it wasn't for the fact that of Walter E. Williams, I wouldn't have been led on to Cato, the Cato Institute, and the Reason Foundation, and then Drew Carey and The Reason, and Reason Magazine, and Reason, all this stuff. But so the seeds had been planted very early before my first Iraqi deployment that maybe something wasn't quite right about this. So after that first Iraq deployment, I you know, and you really started to see how the sausage was made in the intelligence organization. And then the insurgency really started ramping up when I was there in 2004 and got subsequently worse over the subsequent years. And that's when I began to kind of question why we were there. And questioning the extensive reach of the empire because of the war on terrorism. And this waste associated with conducting the war on terrorism. The blowback argument really didn't solidify in my mind until later. And you began to just kind of look at the world a little bit differently. I was the first to really look at Vladimir Putin as a gangster. It's like, this guy's a gangster. This guy has every trait of a gangster. He runs a gangster regime. Why would Bush look into his eyes and see his soul? Is Bush really as stupid as the liberals are letting him on to be? But, you know, 2004 came along. Kerry was running. Everybody was calling Bush a war criminal. I don't like being called a fucking war criminal because, you know, I'm just doing my fucking duty. So yeah, you know, subsequently I snapped back into my neocon tendencies and believed in the mission, and we just, you know, I just kept going. But the seed of doubt was planted in my head after that 2004 deployment. And so subsequently I just kind of would just keep reading libertarian sources. I discovered the Ludwig von Mises Institute. I would read capitalism.org, Leonard Peikoff, Lou Rockwell, Thomas Sowell. I would read, who was it? I think I got a little bit of Jeffrey Tucker in from time to time. I read Ludwig von Mises. I read Hayek. I actually did read a book or a essay from Murray Rothbard very, very early that definitely questioned my loyalty to the Cold War being a strictly black and white justifiable conflict, so to speak, that had to be fought. And I only looked at it from the US and American perspective, but truly, if you think about the argument that I read in this Murray Rothbard essay about the Soviets simply wanting a buffer because they had been invaded twice in the past 100 years. Okay. I can be sympathetic to that argument. And the incestuous relationship between France, Germany, Europe, and the sanctions regime that they were openly undermining. And while they might have been on the correct moral grounds for opposing our invasion of Iraq, if you really look back at it, it was our warfare state versus their warfare state. They were selling shit to Saddam. They were profiting off of the oil for food program. It was absolutely corrupt. And this has began my kind of mistrust of really international institutions I had once found to be allies. Or at the very least, like, well, don't they believe in the things we believe in as Americans in a free and open world? And that was eye-opening. All that was very eye-opening. All those seeds have been planted. And so that pivot moment, that moment, everything that kind of got me thinking I'm a little more libertarian than I was definitely, without a doubt, that 2004 deployment to Iraq. That completely changed my perspective. I went to subsequent places like Ethiopia and Pakistan, and you really kind of understand we didn't understand the true complexities of the war on terrorism as a populace, but I don't even think as a government we did. We knew we were working with scoundrels in Pakistan. I should know. We were working with them. And they weren't necessarily the Taliban or the Khan network, right? Ethiopia, the same thing. Government failure. Just government failure. I mean, illustrated beyond a shadow of a doubt. And you start putting these pieces together, and like you understand that, like, global hegemony is what we're maintaining to keep America safe. And I'm willing to, I'm still actually willing to accept that argument, but there's catastrophic cost to that. And I didn't have, I just didn't have a word for it until the 2007-08 campaign of this little old man that I used to hear on the Larry Elder show from time to time, from Texas, by the name of Dr. Ron Paul. The name he gave it was Blowback. And at the time, during this so-called Giuliani moment that so many other libertarians have you know, called, you know, their, road to Damascus moment, I wasn't, I was convinced of libertarianism, but just not on a foreign policy standpoint. I just believed in what we were doing to a lesser extent. But, and honestly, truly, Dr. Paul's argument at the time fell on deaf ears even for me. I'm just like, shut up, man. You know, Ron's cool, man. He needed to just shut up, man. He ain't know. You know, I'm on the ground, man. I've been in these places, man. Like, yo. And I still do hold this belief. I'm like, yo, Muslims are fucking crazy. And like, if not checked, they're going to kill us. What gave nuance to that perspective is, yeah, they do want to kill us, and yeah, they probably might be fucking justified. So the blowback argument worked. That word was blowback, and I'm like, that's what it was. That's what I was seeing in all the places I'd been working in intelligence. And so, yeah, it was an awakening moment. But at the end of the day, man, I'm voting for McCain and his haughty vice presidential nominee. Because come on, man, you got to admit, back then Sarah Palin was probably up to that point like one of the hottest vice presidential candidates I'd ever seen. This is like she's just a regular white woman, but she was a damn sexy white woman. And, you know, she was very homely and very wholesome and very, aw shucks. And I didn't really like McCain. I didn't like McCain back in 2000. I thought he was a dick. But, you know, it's his turn. I'm still team GOP. Rush Limbaugh was pretty lukewarm about him. I was listening to Hannity and all these guys. And just like, hey, man, this is we got to stop this Barack Obama guy. Whose speech I did see in 2004 and like inspired the shit out of me too. But, you know, we had our chance with Colin Powell and we just didn't take it. And so it's like, yeah, I think that brother might win. And lo and behold, you can't, that tie to history. I don't think even if the financial crisis hadn't happened in 2007, 2008, I think Barack Obama would have won easily. And truth be told, he did kind of win kind of easily. But that even then didn't sway me, because I'd also discovered like some Austrian economic stuff. I mean, that stuff really didn't make any sense. You've read excerpts from Human Action over the years, but I did believe in the gold standard because for a while like Cato kind of advocated it. Ron Paul, that was always his thing. Most libertarians, when it came to monetary policy, were either Chicago School or these Austrian economic guys or whatever. And so I believed in it. I saw the rationale as to why the financial crash happened. And in early, late 2007, I was that guy in the back of the break room with all the like markers pointing all around and like, looking all crazy conspiracy paranoid. I mean, I was that meme about like, hey man, the CDO shit is real. This, these credit default swaps, man, this shit is real, man. This shit is gonna fucking crash and burn. And I can get into the history of how like I kind of saw that coming, but like didn't really know what to give it. But I wasn't a prognosticator. I was just like, wow, that stuff really is me. But it definitely these real world experience helped solidify, at least for my economic thoughts about how the Federal Reserve kind of sucked. I'm not a guy that wants to necessarily end the Fed, but we should damn sure taper the Fed and, like, get rid of its influence, or at the very least allow a free market alternative to the Federal Reserve. You know, but I digress on that. Okay, so, you know, we're getting into the point where, like, my ultimate evolution started happening. So I'm dibbling and dabbling out of libertarianism over the years. You know, Romney runs, and yeah, he's kind of a milquetoast guy, and he really doesn't win. And, you know, that and the other thing. You know, it's kind of weird, but I still wasn't really libertarian enough. I was happy to see the Ron Paul campaign reignite in 2012. I was especially happy to see Gary Johnson, who was a guy who was governor when I got here in 1998, and one of the few governors that said, "Hey, man, this weed shit, maybe we should legalize it." He's one of the first. Granted, he was in the last year of his term and of his term, limited term as governor. But Gary Johnson was a good governor. Say what you will about Johnson now, and particularly back in 2016, that was an abysmal fucking performance. That is not the Gary Johnson I knew. But, you know, it was good, and so I started paying attention to the Libertarian Party, and found it, as always, wanting. So, at this point, I was kind of wandering in the wilderness. We were dealing with another 4 years of Barack Obama, but, you know, at the same time, I was like, I mean, I was slightly apolitical. I was listening to my Rush Limbaugh every day. I was, but I was also listening to Glenn Beck a little bit. And, you know, I'm still a fan of Glenn Beck, and, you know, don't hold that against me. But, you know, I would find it like he was my spiritual. Yeah, he was my spiritual guide, and like Rush was just like red meat or whatever. But I just kind of digressed into my work life, and you know, I didn't really do a whole lot of politics and stuff. I was working a lot in the Bay Area, and so I would listen to a lot of tech podcasts and read a lot of technical blogs and stuff like that, because I was really into startups and tech and business and my job and my line of work in satellite communications and comms. And you know, I was a political guy. I was right of center. I was conservative and stuff like that. I guess if you could call me that back then. But I mean, I don't know, man. It wasn't like I was terribly political. It wasn't until the politics really started sneaking into the tech blogs that I would frequent. And really, like, the Bay Area, like, people tend to think, like, oh, it's just a kooky California Bay Area. It was actually very, techno-libertarian-like, you know? It was really great. I mean, they didn't trust the government. They didn't trust the state. And they were building systems without permission, which is very disturbing, because I just read an article in the Wall Street Journal about how tech companies are now asking for permission and not forgiveness. So we're getting to this quickly, to the point where, like, gone are going to be the days of the companies like Uber and Facebook, and that just bust into markets and just do things and disrupt. They're always going to ask Mother May I before they innovate, which is why I don't like this whole thing about regulating AI and all this other shit and whatever like that. You're not going to get the innovations you want if you're asking for permission. You should develop cautiously, but never ask for permission. That's not how disruption happens. The people who have now brought down our carbon footprint and now will have us as the top oil exporting nation on the planet by next year didn't ask for permission. They fracked. Now, you know, you ask for forgiveness if you want to do any new oil exploration, if you want to use any new fracking techniques and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you know, you should never ask for permission. You should just do it and then ask for forgiveness. That's reckless, I know. But we're radicals, aren't we? But that ethos was there in the valley at that time. And I liked it. But then something happened. A lot of those motherfuckers started working for the administration. I think what started happening was the Silicon Valley was so behind Barack Obama. in the sense that he was so transformative because he had a CTO. You know, that's the first time we'd ever had one at the federal government level, at the executive level. He was doing the open government initiative, where, you know, he wanted to make government an API. And a lot, and these were very good things, right? Like the open health records thing. These were all good initiatives. But these people just got co-opted by it, and they thought that the government was the only way to do these things. And this co-opted a lot of people. A lot of the people that sit on the boards of these Web 2.0 companies that are now household names today went to D.C. and became lobbyists and left of center. And so now you have what you have. And so that started eking into all of my podcasts. I just wanted to know about new startups. And tech, and you know, vulnerabilities and cybersecurity and stuff like that. And then it became political, particularly with the net neutrality debate. That drove me insane because it was technological. I think it was willful technological ignorance for advocating for the very same organization in the FCC that was giving Howard Stern shit back when I was listening to him in the mid 90s. And so to me, I just saw that the co-opting nature of the state start to slowly eat its way into the brains of people who knew better, who built great companies. And so it drove me insane. But between Solyndra, which is something I saw come up, fall apart in California, the NUMMI plant in Fremont going to Tesla, and just the co-option, you just saw the insidious nature of the state just spread. How do you stop this? So we're going to move to 2015 and the dissension of our Orange Lord Emperor down that escalator to announce his candidacy. And forever will that man be the man who finally turned me to ANCAP curiosity. When I look back at the 2016 campaign, a lot of things bother me. And maybe it was just a little bit of PTSD. Maybe it's the fact that, like, you know, everything I thought I believed up to that point about conservatism, the GOP, and whether or not there was a libertarian moment even happening in the GOP, were all blown up by a carnival act, blown up by a sideshow, something I didn't think was serious. Going into 2015, into 2016, I was lied to by the Reason crowd and by people on the conservative side that there was this conservative libertarian nexus redeveloping. As I would later learn, that is nothing more than old-school fusionism and something that had been tried before, and it failed in the past and failed in this election. I was told that Rand Paul was the second coming of his father. I should hope not. I wasn't that big of a Ron Paul fan, but I genuinely liked the policies that his son espoused. He was Ron Paul light. And while a lot of hardcore ANCAPs and those who came to the party because of Ron Paul wouldn't necessarily co-sign that type of libertarian light, at the very least, he stuck behind really a couple of principles that I also agreed with, as well as his father. Non-interventionism was quickly becoming kind of the norm in the low rumblings of the conservative movement, particularly the old Tea Party coalition, which had been subsequently co-opted and destroyed by the GOP. Most importantly, constitutionalism was something I was hell-bent on, which is why I was kind of semi-swayed by Ted Cruz, and to a lesser extent Marco Rubio. But as the 2016 campaign got underway, i.e. in the form of the GOP nominating process, it started to become very, very apparent that it wasn't the coalition that I thought I was a part of. This conservative, libertarian, like, fusion nexus resurrected from the 90s wasn't necessarily happening. To be exact, it wasn't what I had thought at all. A lot of people who I thought were allies in the libertarian moment, as it was coined, really weren't allies in the first place. They were, deep down, tribal. But what had made them tribal? Now, at first, I just dismiss these people as just basically, racist. Particularly when I use the example of Ann Coulter, who subsequently threw anything resembling conservatism out the window to go behind and Trump We Trust, even if he were to, have abortions in the Oval Office, quote unquote, As long as he built the wall, she was fine. And the scared little white girl syndrome persisted. What the hell was going on? What do you mean? Building the wall? That's ridiculous. He's not going to build a wall. Look, we've got to get back to constitutionalism. We've got to get back to, you know, free markets. We've got to get back to... Didn't matter. And I came to an ugly conclusion on during the Indiana primary that as Trump secured the necessary delegates to outright win at convention, as governor then Mike Pence gave a half-ass endorsement of Ted Cruz going into that primary and subsequently was selected as his vice presidential nominee for the GOP, that fusion didn't exist. The people who are in our midst were sick and tired. They listened to the dog whistles of Donald Trump, as much as those dog whistles existed. They embraced identity. They were sick and tired of being called racist, sexist, bigots, homophobes. And someone as cartoonish as Donald J. Trump came down that escalator and said, fuck that. And non-interventionism, conservatism, free markets, constitutionalism, free trade disappeared. Was completely was gone. It was destroyed. And it became strictly about beating the left. As a New Mexico primary rolled in, I went into the local polling station that day. Cast my obligatory vote for Ted Cruz, hoping upon hope that maybe enough apportioned delegates would allow Cruz to maybe stage a contested convention. But subsequently after that vote, I changed my registration to Libertarian, and I began to watch the slow train wreck of the Libertarian Party nominating process, and found it wanting. So that's to say that like this was an epiphany for me. And so I just kind of dug deep into the politics of everything that had culminated up to that point. My like and dislike for Reason and Reason TV, my like and dislike for Penn Jillette, who I'd seen alive actually, and I like his act. From Lars Limbaugh to Walter E. Williams, to the radicalism of Rothbard and Hoppe, to the radicalism of Larkin Rose, Adam Kokesh, Daryl Perry, all these things started me down this road where maybe, just maybe, the philosophy of libertarianism was good enough for me to at least live my life by, realign my politics toward, and maybe, just maybe, affect the political process. So, after I saw Austin Peterson go down in flaming defeat, be gracious enough to accept that defeat only to have the Johnson Weld campaign spit in his face, and after seeing Larry Sharp, who came from practically nowhere to almost beat Governor Weld, I began to think that maybe, just maybe, with the fuckery that was the Libertarian Party in 2016 and its catering to the left, which I can't stand when it does that, maybe, just maybe, I should just stop bitching on the internet and start the process of becoming a participating member of the party. Well, in closing, I mean, I'm not going to say that this has been a coherent journey down my ideological transformation. There's some things I probably left out. Penn and Teller had a great effect on me. Howard Stern had a very good effect on me. South Park had a very big effect on me. I listened to some, Michael Savage. I read a couple of his books back before he went full Trumpist. Then there was the fact that I saw lots of people who I listened to and respected, and, you know, followed on Fox News and Twitter, just kind of each kind of fall by the wayside slowly to Trumpism and tribalism, and just owning the libs is what they wanted to do. And I'll be damned if ideological purity or anything resembling anything Russell Kirk-like in conservatism, Reaganism, no Goldwater like Republican, like, none of that stuff seemed to exist anymore. That was all gone now. It was Trump's party. Cruz was booed out of the convention. Him and his wife had to be escorted out by guards. Rand Paul was beaten down and had to ultimately kiss the ring and endorse. And again, Austin Peterson, you know, and to a lesser extent, Larry Sharp weren't given the opportunity to become what they became. And they catered to Bernie Sanders leftists, Bernie bros, because they wanted that disenfranchised group. And I can't doubt them. That's where the energy was. Because your ex-GOP Tea Party types that were kind of dejected because the Trump train pulled off without them might not have been the best people to go after, because I could tell you for a fact, as someone who was very, very into what the Tea Party was doing, was very, very into what was happening when it came to this libertarian moment, and maybe the libertarian infiltration of the GOP was actually going to happen. Fusionism had been re-resurrected. I thought this was our time, right? At the very least, you could have a constitutional conservative and libertarian, classical liberal reemergence within the GOP. When that was strangled in its crib, what do you do? Where do you go? You go to Libertarian Party. Libertarian Party doesn't want conservatives. They don't want anything resembling anything like right of center, when it at least in 2016. And I'm sorry, the Libertarian Party was much more ideologically aligned with the Tea Party crowd than they were the Bernie bros. They were never going to get the Bernie Sanders people to come over to their side. All these guys are now sitting in the resistance wearing pussy hats and, screaming at 20,000 decibels every time Trump, kicks a puppy. But the Libertarian Party doesn't seem to understand that. That's why I joined. Because I intend very, very simply, I'll put my plan out there, is to infiltrate the Libertarian Party of my state and to build the biggest, most conservative caucus within the state party to get my delegates to Austin in 2020, and to make an impact in the political process. And it's good now that there's all these celebritarians making the move. The question is, will they stick around till 2020? They have to, if there's any going to be anything resembling a transformation. Because the more paleo-libertarian types are my people. Now, do they hold some views when it comes to neo-confederacy? Is there a slight on the fringes libertarian to alt-right pipeline? Of course. Of course there is. But every fringe movement, every movement has its fringes, and there are these fringe movements that sometimes break away and form their own thing. I don't want socialists in the party. I don't give a shit. Maybe that's just me putting a litmus test on this, but I don't want to deal with that. I've seen what tribalism and identitarianism and owning the libs mentality gains you in the party. It gains you a Trump. It throws out principle, and it becomes warfare. And the Libertarian Party needs to be more than that. It needs to directly represent the ideology that is true liberalism in its most radical forms. Radical forms that gave us the Constitution. Those radical forms that gave us the Emancipation Proclamation, when it came to the John Browns of the world absolutely, positively not standing for any more servitude for man. So yeah, we need that back. We don't need any milquetoast, watered down nonsense. Because I love telling this to libertarians because it irks the shit out of them. You are in Western civilization. You are the right. Learn to embrace it. And just because there are definitely terrible elements on the right does not mean that you can't espouse your values from the right. You are the right. You are the right. That's what you're considered now. Suck it up. You're never going to reclaim liberalism. Libertarianism is your title. You don't like conservatism because at the end of the day, conservatism isn't really libertarianism because it is not as radical as libertarianism. It's not as radical as it, but you're never going to get back liberal. And by saying you're classically liberal, it's not going to get you any leftists. Because the moment you say taxation is theft, or at the very least espouse the point that maybe government's a little bigger than it should, you are of the right. It's time to embrace it. And stop embracing this agnostic, atheistic shit. Because if you want a free and open society, you can't rip down those institutions. For good or for bad, that has advanced Western civilization. Long before, the radicals that gave us the, what is the most extreme form of revolution we've had? Probably the French Constitution, the French Revolution Constitution, I don't know what that thing's called, something of the rights of man or whatever. All that stuff was fantastic. Well, most of that stuff was fantastic. A lot of that shit was really just kind of ripping down institutions and stuff, and that's radicalism and nihilism taken to its utmost extreme. You cannot have that in a free and open society, because what takes its place always, inevitably, is statism. Period. Point blank. You can see that only in the environmentalist movement. Those guys are sitting back, atheists as fuck, using all their logic and reason, and at the end of the day, they are willing to basically promote an anti-human religion, and that's what it is. We have to push people away from the religion of the state and more to the religion of the self. That's objectivism, that is Catholicism, that's Protestantism, that's even, Islamism. It is religion. Because if you don't have that spiritual underpinning, you're not going to build a free and open society. You're just not. Because we have to build communities. We have to build families. We have to build this stuff from the ground up. And leftists are nihilists. They don't want any of those things. And I don't have a problem with the LGBTQ community. Why am I even using Q? That's so preposterous. Q and B are preposterous, but I digress. I don't have any problem with those people. But at the end of the day, I don't have to co-sign their hedonism. And that is what you end up doing in the political philosophy that has no objective grounding in anything remote to spirituality, community, anything. It doesn't matter. If you don't believe in anything, if you have no underpinning for that, then it doesn't matter. Freedom in and of itself isn't enough. To be exact, it should probably be constrained, but not by the force of violence of the state. And that's how I've gotten here, man. I wish I could be more radical, right? I'm not an ANCAP. I'm sorry. But I do believe that its philosophical underpinnings definitely help you know when I should let my friend do X. Like Larry Sharp says, can I let my friend, or will I let my friend cut my lawn? Will I let my friend, fix my car? If he's competent, will I let my friend cut my hair? Will I let my friend give me, orthoscopic surgery? Sorry. No, I will not. All right. Well, we should probably put some constraints on that, or maybe even license that or stuff like that. But that license doesn't necessarily have to be issued by a central authority of guys with a monopoly on the use of force. Why can't we get behind that? White identitarians, fine. That's all well and good, as long as they can live in their ethnostate with, you know, properly acquired property rights. Sure. Are we necessarily going to co-sign evictions? If they're true libertarians, they will not use aggression to force people off their property who are not like them if they want to build their ethnostate. But here's the deal. Ethnostates never last long. It's just history. There's always a certain amount of minority and there's a certain level of plurality to a culture because a culture can't be insulated. It just can't happen. It just won't happen. And history's proven it won't happen. And it's never a threat. It's never going to be a threat of happening. Only when you push against it will it probably become a possibility. And once people who feel that their identity is under assault get the reins of the state and its power to use force and violence, you've created the very thing you were hoping to rebel against by having people sign pledges that they're not Nazis. So that's why I'm going to join the party and I'm going to change this shit. At least in my state. Because there's a lot of shit in my state that needs to be done right. There's a lot of fuckery in the party. It's why I do activism as opposed to strictly party business. Because there's a pragmatism to me that may drive certain people crazy. But I want to understand the right. The extreme right. I want to understand the extreme left. But I can't seem to find extreme leftists to copacetically follow. I don't know. Anyway, I've gone on long enough with my rantings and ravings about my philosophical, like, awakening. But if I can be much more disciplined about kind of breaking out these types of, like, you know, long-form podcasts that I hope I can upload. Going forward, man, I think I need to keep doing this so I can just kind of suss out portions of my philosophy that conforms to a little bit of Goldwater conservatism, with a little bit of Russell Kirk conservatism, with a little bit of Rothbard, Hoppe, Hayek, Mises, you know, all these guys kind of have built me into the type of libertarian I want to be. I want to be a right of center, much more culturally conservative libertarian. And there's still a ways for me to go. I still am not a big advocate of complete open borders. But I understand the anarchist argument for it. I do also still have reservations about absolutely just hating the state of Israel. Having been to that region, I don't trust Arabs. I just don't. But I don't know. That's just bigotry and racism in my estimation that I just need to work out. I need to work out. You know, I still believe in the ending the drug war. I think criminal justice reform is now more of a thing. I'm not of the Black Lives Matter variety, but I'm definitely sympathetic to their arguments before they went full Marxist and social justice. But I definitely believe that, like, while cops are not my friend, they are not necessarily the enemy. So yeah, I'm not that extreme. I don't hate cops. I don't hate the military. They do what they're told. And thank God they do what they're told. Because if they didn't do what they're told, and if they were all conscientious objectors, we'd probably have no protection. And if they could at any time decide not to follow the orders they're given, they could easily just create coups. So, no, I'm not for, you know, that type of anarchy, so to speak. But I definitely believe that the wars we've been involved in over the past 15 years have taken its toll. And I just sat with group of vets that, you know, have fought in previous wars that are having a tough time getting vets coming back from the Afghanistan and Iraqi theaters, man, who really are dealing with the toll of this. And we really have to understand the toll that these conflicts take, not just on the people that we're sanctioned to murder, but with the effects of being told and sanctioned to do that. And like, the human capacity to deal with that. Human beings don't like murdering each other, man. They don't. It is so unnatural. It's why abortion is not... It's why abortion isn't like this thing that everybody just wants to do. They don't want the choice to do it, right? It's kind of like the military. Like, you want the choice to be able to defend yourself against a foreign invasion or to project force somewhere you see a threat. But you don't... You do understand once you engage in that activity... It's fucking terrible, right? We're a culture of life here, and it's tough. And so, yeah, I'm not anti-military. I may be anti their mission, I may be anti-intervention, but I'm not anti-military, right? And so, you know, that's kind of where I just diverge a lot with a lot more of the extreme elements of the, I call it our religion, that is libertarianism. So, you know, I'm still learning, still growing, and I'll get there. And I'm only one day into my 6 months away from being an ANCAP. So, we'll keep going. All right, guys. Ladies.